We have gauge symmetries in the standard model. Those, of course, are local symmetries. But there are also global symmetries in the standard model as well. And those are not things that we put in by hand. We didn't want there to be global symmetries necessarily, but they are there. And symmetries of those types are known as accidental symmetries. So it is just a symmetry that emerges naturally due to the fact that you can't write down any terms in the Lagrangian that violate the symmetry. So this is just a global symmetry. That results from not being able or not being allowed to write any symmetry breaking terms. In the Lagrangian. And the reason that you can't write down those terms, of course, is also due to symmetry, but it's due to some other symmetry that we did want to keep. So for example, due to gauge invariance, or Lorentz symmetry. OK, so there's ultimately a symmetry reason why we cannot write down these terms. In the standard model, there's four accidental symmetries. They're all U1 symmetries. So there's four accidental. I should write U1 here. Those symmetries are baryon number, B, and lepton flavor symmetries. There's three lepton flavors, so we have three of these. E, L mu, and L tau. So just to be clear, maybe it's obvious what these mean, but we'll go through each one to describe what these symmetries are. So baryon number just means that all quark fields transform. So if I just think about what terms in the Lagrangian involve quarks, they always have this structure. So I have something like Q bar, some Dirac gamma matrix structure. It doesn't matter what it is. And then some other quark field here. And in general, these two quarks might be different for the case of the charge-current interaction, for example. OK. Gamma and some Dirac matrix. It could also involve some color structure as well. So of course, if I transform all of the quarks under the same U1 global transformation, terms like this are invariant. So under all quarks, transforming by the same global U1 phase. So all quarks fields go to the same field, and I just rotate by a phase. So U bar is the same thing. A Q-bar is the same thing, just with the opposite face. Okay, so Lagrangian's invariants, and then also the other fields would be invariants under this transformation. Okay, so this is just a U1 transformation that acts on quark fields, and this is a baryon number transformation. So they all have the same quantum numbers. I'm free to choose the quantum numbers under this transformation as I like. So this is a U1, denoted as U1 baryon transformation. And the convention is all of the quark fields have baryon number a third. So we have minus a third, of course, for the antiquark fields. Okay, and so it's a consequence of this symmetry that, of course, the lightest baryon is stable. Because if this charge is conserved, there's no lighter state carrying baryon number for the proton to decay into. Okay, so that's baryon number. The other ones are very similar. They are symmetries that act on the lepton fields. And so the three other symmetries are LE, L mu, and L tau. So this is known as a U1 LE transformation. So under this, the electron field transforms under a phase. The new E field transforms under the same phase, but the other fields are invariant. So we are just rotating by a phase all of the fields that carry electron flavor. So again, you're free to define these charges to be anything you'd like. So you would say LE is equal to 1 for the electron and the electron neutrino, and it's equal to 0 for everything else. And it's very similar for these other lepton flavors as well. This one is U1 mu, L mu, and this is U1. L tau. And here I just transform the muon fields. Here I transform the tau fields. All right, and so here the muon has muon lepton number 1. And here, the tau has lepton number 1. OK, it's different. The lepton and quark sectors are a bit different. For the leptons, each flavor of lepton has its own conserved quantum number. And the reason, of course, is the fact that for the leptons, the charge-current interaction preserves the flavor of the lepton. It only changed electron to electron neutrino, and same for the other flavors as well. For the quarks, the charge-current interaction changes quarks from one flavor to the other. And so through a series of charge-current interactions, you can connect all of the different quark flavors together. So there's no sense in which each flavor is separately conserved or each generation is separately conserved for quarks. Of course, if I did go beyond the minimal standard model and introduce masses for the neutrinos, then I would introduce mixing for the leptons. What I want to say is that all three of these lepton flavor quantum numbers are separately conserved. If all of the neutrinos are massless, once you introduce neutrino masses, then they get mixed up. L E and L mu and L tau are not conserved. But the total lepton number L, which is just the sum of all the flavor quantum numbers, could be conserved. Or not, depending on how you introduce neutrino masses. And that's really why I'm not writing down neutrino mass terms yet, because we don't know how they manifest. They could manifest in a way where lepton number is still conserved, or they could manifest in a way such that neutrinos are now their own antiparticle. If that was the case, obviously lepton number doesn't make sense if a particle is the same as this antiparticle. So depending on those two cases, total lepton number may be conserved or it may not be. Okay? So that's accidental symmetries. Yes?
Is it correct to say that these accidental symmetries are just the symmetries that we gauged at the beginning by introducing the gauge fields into the Lagrangian?
No. Okay. We're not gauging these fields. They are global symmetries. Okay. They just emerge because it's not possible to write down anything that violates these global symmetries because of the gauge symmetries that we started with. So if you try to write down an interaction that violates, for example, baryon number, you might be tempted to write down, for example, the coupling of a quark, two quarks. So instead of contracting a Q with a Q bar, I can contract two quarks together, for example. I can form a Lorentz invariant object out of these two things. But because of the color, so I'll call the color indices like A and B, there's no way to contract two fundamentals of SU3 color in order to get an SU3 singlet. I have to contract a fundamental and an anti-fundamental. Okay, any other questions? Yeah.
When you're getting all these like residual symmetries, it seems like you're just using a bad way of writing gauge invariant quantities. Like, is there some other algebraic structure you could use that would just make these all seem like they're manifest in one larger object or something? Because like you're just getting these all seemingly out of nowhere, right? So they must have an explanation somehow.
Are they coming out of nowhere?
Well, like you just said, for example, the quark baryon number there was saved by color.
Yeah.
So I mean, surely there must be some sort of slight upgrading to color that would rationalize that you're going to get these other types of things that are protected.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So you want to embed the standard model in a larger gauge group?
Either a larger gauge group or a different type of algebraic structure, like a super duper group, which would be like, have one extra axiom which would let all these things work or something.
Yeah, okay. So super duper groups are a little bit above my head. But if you want to embed it into a larger gauge group, then it is true that a lot of the seemingly ad hoc features of the standard model do emerge more naturally. So we will come to that a little bit during the very last lecture. Yes?
Is there an intuitive reason why we have a mass matrix for quarks and we have a potential mass matrix for neutrinos, but we don't have one for the other leptons?
In general, you would write that down, but the thing is that you don't need to so far, unless we're doing neutrino, we're studying neutrinos in particular, how they mix together. We would need to introduce a mass matrix for the neutrino sector. But here, we're not dealing with any observables that are sensitive to the neutrino mass. And so we're taking a little bit of a historical perspective, which is we're writing down the standard model with the minimum number of ingredients to describe the physics, which if we're not sensitive to neutrino masses, we don't need to introduce them.
So choose not to introduce that mixing.
We effectively choose not to. And it's really the spirit of minimality. So if I do want to introduce mass terms for the neutrinos, then I have to think about exactly how I'm going to do it. One way to do it would be to introduce a right-handed partner for the neutrino field, the same way all of the other fermions have both left and right-handed chirality fields. But the neutrinos are a little bit subtle because, as I mentioned last week, the right-handed neutrino field is actually a singlet under all of the symmetries of the standard model. So for a field like that, you can write down not just Dirac terms through the Yukawa interaction that we did, but you're actually not forbidden from writing down just a bare mass by itself. It's not protected from existing by a gauge symmetry. So you can write down what's called a Majorana mass for the right-handed neutrino fields. So the structure of the neutrino masses in general is just a little bit more complicated. And we don't actually know what is the correct picture for those. OK, any other questions? We're going to change gears, so feel free to ask questions now if you have any. OK, so the next subject we're going to discuss is known as deep inelastic scattering. And I just want to motivate it in the following way. So I've argued that we have quarks in the standard model, and quarks are bound in hadrons. Of course, all we can observe are hadrons. So how do we know that they are actually made out of quarks? How do we know the quantum numbers of the quarks that make up the hadrons? So these are made out of spin 1/2 quarks. How do we know this? So what you have to do to figure out what a hadron is made out of is you need, of course, a very powerful microscope to be able to see inside of the hadron. To a physicist, a microscope is just probing using a probe of sufficiently small wavelength to hit some structure that you want to understand, in this case, the hadron. So unfortunately, if you try to put in energy, a sufficiently small wavelength probe, to see what the structure of the hadron is, you end up putting energy into the hadron and end up just making more hadrons. Of course, one of the problems is confinement. So we can't combine a quark to study its properties. Putting in more and more energy just produces more hadrons. So I just want to draw a little bit of a cartoon. So let's say you have an electron beam. Impinging on a proton. The electron can interact with one of the quarks in the proton because they both carry electric charge. So I can think about a virtual photon that's being exchanged between the electron and the quark. The kick from the virtual photon could try to kick one of these quarks out of the proton. So for example, the other quarks would be going in this direction, and this quark would be going over here. But eventually, once they get too far apart, the potential energy between the two of them becomes so large that it just becomes energetically favorable to pull more quark-antiquark pairs out of the vacuum in order to make objects that are color neutral. So what happens is, I produce a quark-antiquark pair like this. So here I might get a neutron out and some other quarks. And these two quarks might not be bound together very well. They still might have a lot of energy, so they could still separate. But still, at some point, they would pull another quark-antiquark pair from the vacuum. So I might have a U and a D bar. So for example, here I'll have some mesons. And for example, a neutron here. No matter how hard I kick one of the quarks, I'm guaranteed to get out just more and more hadrons. This process is called fragmentation. Or hadronization. And it essentially results from the fact that QCD, theory of the strong interactions, is asymptotically free. The flip side is that the coupling becomes large at low energy, which is a consequence of the beta function. So if I want to plot the coupling for the strong interaction as a function of energy. Or I could plot it inversely versus distance. The coupling becomes small at large energy, which is asymptotic freedom. But as I go to larger and larger distances or smaller and smaller energy, the coupling blows up. And so eventually, at some point, I have a Landau pole. At some scale lambda QCD, which is around 200 MeV. So you can think of hadronization as an effect occurring due to the fact that the strong coupling constant becomes very, very large. So it's a non-perturbative effect. When alpha S becomes large of order 1. So the fact that it becomes 1 at a particular distance scale, particular energy scale, sets the typical energy scale for hadronization. So I can think of the distance scale over which hybridization occurs as of order the inverse of this energy scale, which is around a femtometer. So qualitatively, you can think of a quark getting kicked. It travels around a femtometer and then pulls out a quark antiquark pair, and so on. And of course, it's no surprise that this femtometer scale is also the typical size of hadrons. The proton radius is around a femtometer. Okay. So the flip side of this is asymptotic freedom. Tells me that at small distances, at energy scales much, much larger than lambda QCD, or distances much, much smaller than a femtometer, quarks behave as free fermions. Or maybe I should say, not necessarily free, but weakly coupled fermions. Since the coupling constant for the strong interaction is small. OK. So if I combine these two facts, I come up with an important result known as factorization. So if we take both together, we get this idea known as factorization. And it basically says what happens at small distances isn't affected by the dynamics at large distances. So here I'm talking about distances much, much smaller than a femtometer, here of order a femtometer. OK. Now, it's hard to state how important factorization is for experimental particle physics. For example, you might be worried, given that we collectively have spent billions and billions of dollars to collide hadrons together at very high energies, how am I able to predict anything for high energy collisions, like at the Large Hadron Collider, if I'm not able to solve the physics of the strong interaction, if I'm not actually able to compute the dynamics of the strong interaction. But we are, and the reason is due to factorization. So just to paraphrase what I just said, this allows us to compute high energy processes involving quarks even if we can't solve for the initial state. So for example, that would be protons at the LHC, or the final state. You collide two protons together at very high energy, you'll just get a lot of hadrons plus maybe some other stuff. So you might think of this as hopeless, right? If I can't solve exactly for the initial state or the final state, how can I even predict anything? Okay, so later in the course, we're going to be dealing with what happens when you collide together two protons. Here, we're going to look at this simpler case of deep inelastic scattering, where I have an electron beam and a proton target. So we're going to consider electron-proton scattering. And we're going to be very general here. So basically, I'm going to do this calculation of this scattering process in two different ways. The first way that we're going to proceed with today, we're not going to put in anything about the strong interaction. Assume we knew nothing about the strong interaction and see what we can actually compute. Then tomorrow, we're going to compute it again, but we'll put in the fact that our target is made out of quarks. And we'll put in, that's all we have to put in, actually, and you'll see what we get in that case. Okay. So here is a diagram corresponding to the process that I want to look at. So we have an electron beam. It's incoming with momentum L, and it's outgoing with momentum L prime. It scatters through a virtual photon with momentum Q. And it hits a proton target. I don't really care too much about what happens when it hits, because I don't know anything about strong interaction. But what I'll get out will be just a bunch of hadrons coming out. So I might get a bunch of hadrons because of fragmentation. So this will be hadron 1, 2, 3, dot, 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 to n. And all of this together will be my final hadronic state H. This proton will have an initial momentum P. Also, L is the initial electron. L prime is the final electron. And I'll call P prime the total final hadronic momentum. So this would be P prime 1 plus P prime 2, et cetera. OK, so the sum of all of the four momenta for all of the hadrons in the final state. Another thing is I'm going to assume that this electron beam is at high energy. So I can neglect the electron mass. And also, I have a momentum Q, which is just L minus L prime. OK. One other thing. This process here, where I go from a proton to many hadronic final states, is known as inelastic scattering. But I can also think about elastic scattering. Elastic scattering just means you have the same particles in the initial state as in the final state. So in that case, I would have a proton in the final state, just like I had a proton as my initial hadron. Okay. So before we actually try to compute something, it's helpful to just define a bunch of different kinematic variables. These are all going to be Lorentz invariant variables. And then our calculation moving forward will be defined in terms of these. And these are just the standard definitions for deep inelastic scattering. There's four of them we're going to introduce. So the first one is called Q squared, capital Q squared. This is just minus little q squared. And this variable is just known as the momentum transfer squared. The reason I defined it with this minus sign here is just the fact that big Q squared is now always positive. So this is minus L minus L prime squared. And so this is 2 L dot L prime. Electron mass, remember, is 0. And this should just be 2 EL EL prime 1 minus cosine theta. So 1 minus cosine theta is always greater than 1, or maybe 0. So this quantity here is always greater than or equal to 0. Okay. So that was, I forgot to mention also theta is just the scattering angle. I can't reach up there, but. So this is the scattering angle for the electron. Okay, next variable. So the other variable we define is known as nu, and it's just defined as the proton momentum p dotted into q divided by the proton mass. Okay, so I defined it in this way to make it a Lorentz invariant scalar, but it has a very natural interpretation in the rest frame of the proton, the initial proton, which would be the lab frame if I'm imagining protons are a fixed target. So let's imagine a lab frame where the initial proton is at rest. So the proton momentum would just be just the mass. So in this frame, I would have nu is equal to me, and then it's just dotted into the zero component of q, which is el minus el prime, and then, mp here, and then divided by mp. So this is just the difference in energies between the incoming electron and the outgoing one. This is just the energy transfer. In the lab frame. Okay, three. Is a variable little y, which is p dot q over p dot l. So another Lorentz invariant scalar. Let's also work in this lab frame. So p dot l is just the proton mass and then the initial lepton mass. So I can plug in here, and this is EL minus EL prime over EL. So this is also an energy transfer. It would be the fractional energy transfer in the lab frame. Okay, then we have one more variable to do, and that is x, and it's defined as minus q squared over 2p dot q. Or I could write it as big Q squared over 2p dot q. Or I could use nu to write it as q squared over 2mp times nu. Okay, so you can express it different ways. This is just named after the person that wrote it down, Bjorkane X. Okay, all of these variables are Lorentz scalars, so they're the same in any frame. They have, some of them have very natural interpretations in particular frames, though. Let's discuss the meaning of X, because it will be important in what follows. So what is the meaning of x? So let's first consider elastic scattering. That means that this state h is also a proton. And the momentum is p prime. Okay, so p prime squared is just mp squared. And by momentum conservation, this is l plus l prime minus p squared. Or I could think of it as, p prime is this one. L plus p minus l prime. So I could think of this as q plus p squared. And so if I expand this out, I have q squared plus 2q dot p plus p squared is just mp squared. So the mp squareds will cancel from both sides. And I will just get q squared is equal to minus 2 q dot p. So if I just rearrange it a little bit, I get minus q squared over 2q dot p is equal to 1. So this quantity here is just x. So I have x is equal to 1. So x is equal to 1 for elastic scattering. Okay, now we'll do inelastic scattering. So I want to consider p prime squared. But now I have many states in the final state because it's inelastic. So I'll have p1 prime plus p2 prime plus dot, dot, dot up to pn prime squared. So this whole thing, whenever I dot one momentum into itself, I'll just get the mass of whatever that state is. But then I'll also have a bunch of cross terms. So for example, I'll have a sum over all of the different masses plus all of these cross terms, et cetera. And this object is always larger than just the proton mass squared. Okay, so if I compute the following, p prime squared minus mp squared, using the same manipulations as over here, this is 2 p dot q plus q squared, which is 2 p dot q, 1 minus x. This quantity is always greater than 0. Okay. Also, p dot q is just equal to nu times mp. This quantity here is also greater than 0, since the energy transfer is positive. So putting these two things together, we have the fact that 1 minus x is greater than 0, or x must be less than 1. We have another condition on x, which is that q squared, we argued, is always positive. This number is also always positive. So the ratio is positive. It must be greater than 0. Also, x is greater than 0, since q squared is greater than 0. So we have an allowed range for x, which is that x should be between 0 and 1. Okay. So the punchline is that for elastic scattering, x has to be fixed at 1. For inelastic scattering, x is a continuous variable, but it's within this range between 0 and 1. Okay, so I want to remind you of a fact. So if you have 2-to-2 scattering, you can write the differential cross section in terms of independent variables, Mandelstam variables, S, T, and U. You can imagine that S itself is fixed by the total center of mass energy of your experiment. And so that leaves you with T and U. They're not both independent, you know. Only one of them is independent. So if you compute the differential cross section, d sigma by d cos theta, it has just one independent kinematic variable. Once the center of mass energy S is fixed. So for example, you can take this to be T. You can take it to be cosine theta. You could take it to be U. OK? Those are the common choices. For elastic scattering, so here we have 2-to-2 scattering. EP goes to EP. We have the same situation. It's a 2-to-2 process. We have just one independent variable. So You can take it to be cosine theta, or you could take it to be one of the variables that we just wrote down. You could take it to be q squared, you could take it to be nu, or you could take it to be y, or you could take it to be t, whatever you like. And this is for s fixed. But for inelastic scattering, we have, in general, more kinematic information, and we have two independent variables. So for this case, x is not an independent variable. S is fixed for elastic scattering, but now x is no longer fixed. So x is now a variable. Plus either q squared, nu, and y, for example. Okay, so that's a point that I want to mention, and it'll be important in what follows, that if we have elastic scattering, we have just one kinematic variable, and if we have inelastic scattering, x becomes another kinematic variable that we have to include. Okay, we've made a bunch of definitions. And with these definitions in hand, we're going to now compute this scattering cross-section. Here's the cross-section we're going to compute. It's going to be called inclusive scattering cross-section. So that means that we're calculating this cross-section, electron scattering off of a proton to make an electron, and some hadronic final state, which is just denoted as x. And so the meaning is that I'm going to consider scattering to a particular hadronic final state. But then at the end of the day, I'm going to sum over all possible hadronic states that are going to appear. And so this will be a sum over all hadronic final states. That's what inclusive means. You're including all possible hadronic final states. Okay, so here's the object we want to compute. So we're summing over hadrons. We have this factor of 2EL times 2EP times the relative velocity. We have phase space integrals for the final states. We have phase space integrals for the final state. We have n different hadronic final states, so we have to sum over all the different hadrons in the final state. So I'll write it as a product like this, and each hadron will have its own momentum. Okay. Now we'll have conservation of energy momentum. And then I'll have the matrix element. Summing over all possible spins for the initial and final state. Okay, so far so good. Now, the thing that I want to write down is the matrix element. So you'll see I'll get stuck pretty fast because I don't know anything, basically. The matrix element is this. So I'll have the lepton part. I know how to write down the momentum space binomials for that part. U bar I e gamma mu U L. I have the photon propagator. And then I have the hadron parts. So this will be an initial proton coupling to transitioning to a final state hadron through an electromagnetic interaction. And so I want to think about a transition from my initial state to my final state. And I know the photon couples through the electromagnetic current, so it must be the electromagnetic current operator that I have here sandwiched in between. So this will be the current and then mu here. What is that current? Well, EJ is E times the sum over all the quarks. This is the electromagnetic current that couples to quarks in the Lagrangian. But one thing is I'm being a little bit sloppy here. I'm working in momentum space. Here I've written down an operator in position space. The operator that appears here should really be the Fourier transform of the current operator. OK, so just to clarify that. Two, I want it to be agnostic. I don't want you to assume that we have quarks in this object. But this would be what it was if we did. But I want to treat this quantity as an unknown. So this object here, this matrix element, is unknown. And it's really unknown because we don't know how hadronization works. I don't know how to take a proton, act on it with some operator that inserts a given momentum with this particular structure, and map that onto some final state set of hadrons. Can't compute that part. OK, so even though I don't know what it is, doesn't stop me from squaring it. So I have matrix element squared. And so I'll have e to the fourth over q to the fourth. I'll have a 1/4. The lepton part, I can do that part pretty easily. I'll have L slash prime gamma mu, L slash, gamma nu. And then I'll have this object squared, which is H, J, E, M, P, and then P, J, E, M, nu, and then H, like this. OK? So next, what we can do is just take this and plug it into the formula for the for the cross section. So here's what I have. And I'm going to be grouping some of the terms together in a particular way, and you'll see why later on. So I have a 2EL. I have this factor of the relative velocity. I'll take one of the 2 pi's from the 2 pi to the fourth and just put it out front. It's just a convention. Then I'll still have this integral over the lepton momentum. I'll have e to the fourth over q to the fourth. I have 1/2, so I'm taking one of the quarters here and moving it to be a half. I have L slash prime gamma mu, L slash gamma nu. Okay, and then I'm going to write down everything that I have left over. So I have a 2e p. I have a sum over hadrons. I have all of these phase space integrals to do. I have 3 powers of 2 pi left over. OK, that's just a convention to move it from here out here. And then I have momentum conservation, L plus p minus L prime minus sum of all the final state hadron momenta. And then I have another 1/2 from the 1/4 and this matrix element. And let me just flip it around a little bit. So we'll have P, J, electromagnetic mu, H, and then H, J, electromagnetic mu, and then P, like this. Okay? So the reason that I flipped it around like this and wrote it in this way is now everything on this second line here, I can just lump together and just represent it as a function with 2 Lorentz indices that now will not depend at all on any of the final state hadronization dynamics. So this quantity here is known as a hadronic tensor, which goes under the name of W. And it has 2 Lorentz indices, mu and nu. And it's just a function of the kinematic variables. Now, you might be a little bit nervous that this stuff here depends on the final state hadrons. And then I'm summing over all of the hadrons. So doesn't this function W also depend on the final state hadrons? But the reason is because I'm summing over hadrons to compute this inclusive cross-section, this function W doesn't care about what's in the final state. I'm summing over all of the final states. And you can see that explicitly because you can think of this part as a sum over intermediate states. So here I have this part here and sum over all hadrons with all possible momenta. So this you can think of as a sum over all possible states. So it's for that reason that this function W doesn't depend on H, because we're summing over it. All right, so we'll stop here for today. We're going to keep going with this cross-section tomorrow. What we're going to do is just take this function and expand it in terms of Lorentz covariant quantities to parameterize it. So again, we're going to parameterize our ignorance and keep going. So we'll pick up with that tomorrow.